you don't have to just worry about what the law is strictly and theoretically. You also have to worry about what the judge thinks the law is. And you really kind of want to color inside the lines. This is not a place to think outside the box or bring your creativity.
Welcome to the Property Management Brainstorm Show with Bob Preston. Bob is the CEO, owner, and broker of North County Property Group, the fastest growing and top-ranked property management company in San Diego County, California. This podcast is for property managers and real estate investors who want to stay on top of leading trends in managing their property assets. You'll hear from leading professionals on the best practices for growing your property management business, successfully renting your properties, and how to make sure your properties are managed correctly. Now, here is your host, Bob Preston.
Hello, and welcome to all you brainstormers who are listening in today. This is Bob Preston, your host of the show, broadcasting from our studio at North County Property Group in Del Mar, California. If you're new here, please subscribe so you have ongoing access to all of our great episodes. And if you like what you hear, please pay it forward with a positive review. Eviction law in California has changed quite a bit over the past year or so, and let's face it, it's gotten pretty complicated. First, with just cause legislation introduced as part of State Assembly Bill 1482, the Tenant Protection Act of 2019, and then with eviction moratoriums introduced as part of the Governor Gavin Newsom state orders in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, called the COVID-19 Tenant Relief Act, or AB 3088. Pretty confusing. So to help us get it all straight and keep track of it, I've invited an expert in landlord-tenant law practicing here in California in the greater Los Angeles area onto the show, Niv Davidovich from the Davidovich Stein Law Group. Hey, Niv, welcome to Property Management Brainstorm.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. And a great way to start today, I would love it, and I'm sure our listeners would love it too, if you would start today by just telling us about yourself, your areas of your law practice and your firm.
Okay. So I'm Niv Davidovich. I'm the managing partner of Davidovich Stein Law Group. We are a real estate, construction, and landlord-tenant-centered law firm. We provide services in those areas on the transactional side and on the litigation side. So on the landlord-tenant side, that includes evictions and making deals with tenants and buyouts, Ellis procedures, procedures to get people out for resident manager occupancies or family or landlord occupancies. So basically the whole gamut of landlord-tenant law, both as it applies to evictions and relocations, as well as transactional, just creating leases, updating those leases for the panoply of new laws that the legislature likes to put out every single year. Keeping leases and landlords and property managers up to date on local rental stabilization ordinances. And a lot of those are either popping up new or they're making changes every year. So that's a lot of our landlord-tenant practice, but we also do just regular real estate and construction practice. So on the transactional side, that's purchase and sale agreements, operating agreements for LLCs, loan docs. On the construction side, it'd be agreements with contractors or architects, things like that. And then on the litigation side, it's what happens when all those agreements go south. And people have to, unfortunately, make claims against one another. So we represent primarily landlords and developers in all sorts of claims like that.
Now, your office is in the greater Los Angeles area. Are your clients primarily in Southern California, in California as a whole?
The majority of the clients, yes, are in the Los Angeles area. However, they have properties which are all over Southern California. Mm-hmm. And we have clients who are all over the state of California. So we have clients up in NorCal. We have clients in San Diego. We have clients in the LA area. And the buildings that we represent through those property managers are in most of the large counties in Southern California, and then a lot of the, you know, more populated areas in Northern California. So basically, we can service anybody who's in the state.
Okay. I read your bio and I got to ask, looks like you also have some music and film publishing in your kind of side gig there. Pretty interesting and fun. I got to ask you about it. What's the deal with that?
A lot of people ask about that. So basically, from the time I was about 6 years old till now, I've been playing music. It's been a big part of my life. And then from the time I was about 15, I started writing songs. And I actually turned it into a career for a little while. So up until about 2008. And I'm a published songwriter and music producer. I've had my songs and recordings in movies, TV shows. And a lot of those songs have been cut by artists in Japan, Germany, United States, UK. So I'm not like a massive music producer or nothing like that, but certainly I've had some of my stuff out there. It's a very exciting time, and actually I'm about to start the process of getting back into it because I really miss it. And, it's a really, really fun part of my life that I want to get back to.
Well, as a father of a 16-year-old daughter who's in a garage band and a high school band, it's fun to be in it, you know, and watching it and be hanging around it, you know, so I can see how that could be really enjoyable for you, even if it's just kind of a side hustle. All right. Well, listen, I'm in property management. Most of our listeners are either property managers or investors who self-manage their own properties. And one of the areas of risk in this business, of course, is the possibility of having to evict a tenant. Nobody wants to ever think about it or have to do it. But, you know, now for the record, we keep this in the context of the state of California, right? Other states may have similar laws, but the conversation today is within that framework within the state because you and I are both licensed in the state of California.
Sure.
So let me start just by asking, in the normal flow of process and for reasons other than COVID, let's set COVID aside just here for a minute. What are the conditions under which a landlord might consider evicting a tenant?
Okay. So if we're setting COVID aside and we're basically saying, let's pretend COVID didn't exist, you have a few basic reasons that you can evict a tenant. I'll start with I'll say the main three, which are described in Code of Civil Procedure 1161, 2, 3, and 4. 2 is the very simple one. Tenant doesn't pay their rent. Even during COVID and certainly prior to COVID, that's the vast majority of evictions that we get. 1161.3 is a cure or quit. That means that a tenant is violating some provision of their lease other than failure to pay their rent. And that would be an example. Examples of that would be things like they have more people in their unit than are allowed to. So 1161.3 would be like, okay, they changed the locks and didn't give the keys back to you. If they have an obligation to pay the utilities and they didn't pay the utilities, that would be an 1161.3 issue. Another 1161.3 issue that most people don't know about is if they fail to pay late fees. You cannot put that on an 1161.2 failure to pay rent notice. So if there are monetary obligations other than the base rent, you have to do that as a cure or quit, not as a pay or quit. Cure or quit being the 1161.3.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 1161.4 is special because that is not a pay or quit or cure or quit. There is no option in 1161.4. It's just you got to go. It's just a notice to quit. Now, there are obviously limited circumstances when you can use one of those, one of them being nuisance. There are a lot of nuisances that are either not curable or you don't have to provide a cure. So most of the time we do 1161.4 is when tenants are just being unruly or just straight up insane or crazy. Once they've done that and it's not an isolated incident, you don't use an 1161.3. You can if you want to, but you don't have to. The other instances where you can use an 1161.4 are an illegal assignment or sublet, or waste. Waste is virtually never used. Waste means that they have done something to the property which is permanent and causes permanent loss of value. So it's just almost impossible to see situations where that's a case, especially with residential tenants. Conceivably could happen if they burn the place down, but short of something pretty severe, we very rarely use waste. It's almost always nuisance or illegal assignment sublet, which we actually get a fair amount.
Where does illegal activity like dealing drugs or doing, you know, baking math.
That would be the other 1161-4.
Gotcha.
I'm glad you asked about that. Illegal activity is a really interesting one. And you raised the example of, did you say dealing meth or doing meth?
Well, or baking it, you know, making it in the property, right? So making it into, anything in that area.
So it's actually very interesting. If you are dealing meth, if you are a meth dealer and you are doing it from your home, that's illegal use of the property. If you're a person who literally just makes meth for your own personal use, you are not selling it. It's questionable whether you can evict that person.
Wow.
Because the illegal use, the 1161-4 for doing something illegal means you're using the property to do something illegal. So if you're running your operation from there, now you're actually using the premises to run an illegal operation. That's a good basis for an eviction. But if you just happen to be doing things which are illegal in the premises, but they don't actually have to do with the premises, you cannot evict someone for that reason. Because let's say someone is cheating on their taxes. They're doing something illegal. And if they're cheating on their taxes in their unit, theoretically speaking, you could evict them now. But of course you can't. The law says you can't. It has to be something that is particular to the premises.
Very interesting.
That's again an 1161-4. Most of the 1161-4s we get are illegal sublets, specifically Airbnbs. So if you're Airbnbing your unit, or if your tenant is Airbnbing your unit without your consent, that is an illegal sublet. And you can evict the tenant for that. And in fact, in some places, such as West Hollywood or even Los Angeles, just advertising the illegal sublet can subject the person to eviction.
Wow. Okay. There's a pay or quit. There's cure or quit. There's, you know, you just kick them out. What are the steps involved in providing those notices and then filing, I guess, ultimately, and when can you do that?
So are we talking residential or just residential?
Just residential.
Okay. Most of them are 3-day notices. If your lease is strange and it happens to have a longer notice than that, then you have to abide by what's in your lease. That's virtually never seen. So for most people, it's 3 days. Now, the law recently changed last year where it became 3 business days. So if you give your notice on, say, January 2nd, and let's call that a Monday, that day doesn't count. It would go 2, 3, 4. And then on the 5th day, if they haven't left the premises, if they haven't cured the breach, if they haven't paid the rent, whatever it is, then that would be the first day that you could file your unlawful detainer. Unlawful detainer and eviction are synonymous. Those are the same things. And basically what an unlawful detainer is it's a lawsuit. A lot of clients call me and they say, just go to the court and get an eviction paper. If it were only that easy. It doesn't work that way. Once you give, you have to give the notice. The notice is a mandatory prerequisite. It's very, very important, because if you mess up the notice, you got to start the eviction all over again. But once you've done the notice and the notice time passes, then you have to go to the next step of filing the unlawful detainer with the court, and then you serve it on the tenant or tenants. And they then have 5 court days again to file some sort of response.
Okay. So if a tenant doesn't pay their rent on the first of the month, at what point would you then serve the 3-day? Is there a grace period in the state of California? I think some people believe there is.
Yeah. So there is no official grace period. No. But the vast majority of leases have some sort of provision in there that says the rent is due on the first, but will not be considered late until either the second, third, fourth, fifth. I've seen all of those different varieties. I've also seen no grace period, but it's kind of rare. When you're dealing with UD, you don't have to just worry about what the law is strictly and theoretically. You also have to worry about what the judge thinks the law is. And you really kind of want to color inside the lines. This is not a place to think outside the box or bring your creativity. You don't want to do things that are unusual, because the judge will pick up on that and might make a mistake and say you did something wrong. But even in making his or her mistake, you're still going to suffer from it. So what we tell people is the official law is like this. You have to wait until the grace period is over. If your lease has no grace period, pretend it does have one. Wait until the third day after it's due before you put up your notice, whether or not you have to or not.
Yeah.
Why? Because most judges see leases with 3-day grace period.
Well, I think it's reasonable to give them some time before you necessarily, you know, serve the notice, or a judge might at least see it that way. We had one scenario where the tenant just didn't move out at the end of their lease. We had asked them to, they told us they would, and they just remained, but didn't pay rent. They claimed that by doing so, things would convert to a month to month. We served them with a 3-day cure notice. And then our attorney told us that was a mistake because we should have just gone right to eviction. Explain that. Correct.
Okay. So basically, once you serve a 3-day notice, you're acknowledging that there's a tenancy.
Yeah.
If there's no tenancy, if they have terminated their own tenancy, you certainly don't want to acknowledge the existence of that which you do not want to exist. Right. So, and a 3-day notice is something you only give to people who are tenants. You don't give 3-day notices to licensees or guests or things like that. And by the way, when we were talking about the 1161, those are the three main things that we talk about. There are also evictions against employee managers. There are also evictions against licensees, which is different than evictions against tenants. So, but back to your question. When someone tells you, here's my 30-day notice, I'm leaving, I want the lease to end when these 30 days expire. Once they do that, and they don't leave after the 30 days, your attorney is right. You go straight to the eviction process because they have done the notice themselves. They're the ones that gave you the notice. The term has ended and you can now go and evict them. Now, that's the basic California law. A lot of your listeners and a lot of people might have properties in places where you have a local rent control ordinance, which treats things differently. So when you have no rent control ordinance and you have a tenant who has stayed past his time and you want to evict them, first, of course, is do not take any rent. This is really important. Do not accept any rent, which is for any period beyond the date which you were expecting them to leave. That is, so for example, let's say you have a 12-month lease and you're in a non-rent control jurisdiction and your building does not fall under California rent control, so you're completely rent control free. At the end of the 12 months, the residential tenant has to leave. If they don't leave, you can go straight to unlawful detainer. You do not have to give them a notice. In practice, most of my clients, and I recommend this for everybody, give 30 to 60 day notices of non-renewal. That is not a statutorily required notice. There's no rule, law, regulation saying you have to do that. But from a practical perspective, if you don't communicate with your tenant that they're expected to leave at the end of the 12 months, they will not know they have to leave. And they will still be there simply because you did not tell them, start looking for a new place to live. So a lot of the times it's not necessarily a matter of courtesy. It's a matter of practicality.
Sure. One of the things I find that people are confused about is what you just mentioned. You know, you called it the 30 or 60 day notice of non-renewal. There's also 30 day notice of rental termination. Yeah. You know, I think there's a difference, right? Because in a lease, you have a defined timestamp where the lease is up. When you're talking about a month to month arrangement, you do actually have to give them written notice at the end of their rental agreement, correct?
Correct. So let's say you do a year lease, typical lease with a tenant. They stay the year, they're nice, you like them, you don't need the property, so they stay there. And then they stay there for a year, 2 years, 3 years, whatever. And they're basically month to month that entire time. Every time they cut you a check, they're buying another 1 month to add to their lease. The underlying terms of the lease still apply, except for that 1 year issue. Basically, that lease turned into a month to month lease. Now, at some point down the road, you decide, okay, I need that space back for whatever reason, right? That is non-discriminatory, of course. At that point, you would have to give that tenant a 60-day notice to quit. And again, remember, there's no cure or quit here. There's no options. They just have to go. right? 60 days is what we see the most often because it's almost always after the 1 year has expired. And mm-hmm. anytime after that 1 year, they're entitled to a 60-day notice.
Is that the same thing as notice to vacate?
Correct. When the technical legal term is notice to quit, but when they say quit, it means vacate.
Okay, which is different though than notice of non-renewal, correct?
Correct. So notice of non-renewal is a courtesy notice you would give before the 12 months expires, right? Letting them know that when the 12th month is over, they have to leave.
Yeah. And right? You don't need to give reasoning for that. It's just that the lease is up and we want you to go, right?
That is correct. And as long as you're doing it for a non-discriminatory reason, then you're perfectly well within your rights to do that, right? Except, of course, if we're talking about a rent control building or a building that's subject to the California rent control.
Okay, let's go back to the case that we had the guy who just stayed. I mean, more or less he became, I think, at least in my vernacular, a squatter. What are squatters' rights and what rights do they have and are the processes different for getting them out of the property and evicting them?
So it really depends on what you mean by a squatter. A person who had a right to stay in the property via a lease, but then decides to stay beyond the time that he contracted to, is technically not a squatter. It's maybe a tenant at sufferance, but it's not a squatter. So
okay.
He basically has the same rights that any other tenant would have. You're just giving him a different kind of notice, right? So again, if we're putting the rent control to the side, a person who's in their lease, as long as they're paying their rent and abiding by the obligations of the lease and not causing nuisance or doing illegal things, you can't evict that person. They have a right to stay there. They're an official tenant. Once the 12 months expires, they have lost their right to stay there. They're not a squatter, they're a tenant at sufferance. And for those people, you would either evict them, like we said, or if they've become month to month, they're entitled to a 60-day notice before you can begin the eviction process. So that's those people. When I think of a squatter, I think of a person who has basically taken up residence in a residential premises with absolutely no permission from the landlord. So for example, a squatter case I had was, I have a client who's a developer. He basically took the onus and the considerable expense of ellising a 3-unit building because he needed to demolish it. So ellising means the existing tenants there got paid relocation and got 120-day notices. And he did all of that the correct way through the city of Los Angeles. And all of the people in those units eventually left. Well, some enterprising chap saw that the building was empty, pretended to be the landlord, listed it on Craigslist. And when people came and responded to him, he gave them leases with his own name on it, not the actual landlord or owner's name. And all of a sudden, when the developer's representatives came to the building, they saw people living in there, right? And the electricity wasn't on. So we actually have no idea how they were operating. There was no electricity. There was no water. They clearly knew there was an issue. But when you call the police, you basically have a 22, 23, 24-year-old guy and his equally young partner show up. They knock on the doors of the tenants. The tenants say, I have a lease. That's when they stop. They don't read the leases. They don't compare the lease to the grant deed. They just say, this is a civil issue. We can't help you. So someone can literally take over an apartment building like that. And you have to then go and do what's called a forcible detainer. A forcible detainer requires a 5-day notice. And then you still have to go and file what is tantamount to an unlawful detainer and still go through the court process. You cannot just come in and evict that person.
Wow, that's amazing. That's a pretty big squatter case. I mean, what about just the person, you know, who finds the doors open and he goes in and starts living there and you don't find out about it, that, you know, maybe it's a homeless person or somebody who just decides, hey, this is pretty nice here. I'm just going to hang out. 30 days later, you find out that there's a person living like in a vacant property. Is that the same exact process you just described?
Maybe, maybe not. It literally depends on what the police officer says at that time And in certain jurisdictions, it depends on whether or not you have filed documents with the local police agency to tell them, hey, this is a vacant building. If you find anyone there, they're trespassers, please remove them. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you are a developer or if you have a building that's been abandoned and you don't want it to become, you know, the homeless Best Western, so you need to do that. You need to put up signs everywhere. It says this is private property. You're a trespasser if you come in without permission. You need to gate it, preferably board up the windows. And then if your local police agency requires it, file the papers with the agency saying, hey, this is a vacant building. If you get a call saying someone's in there, by definition, they are there without my permission. If you do all of those things in LA, they will just take the person out. You will not have to evict them. If you don't do all of those things, but it seems pretty obvious to the police officer that the person is a squatter or that they're homeless, they might still take them out. Other times, if the person doesn't seem like a homeless person, they seem like a regular person who might have gotten bamboozled, like in my story, the police won't take them out. It is very, very unique and circumstance specific.
Wow, that's crazy. I have a little experience with adverse possession. I won't go there because I know that's a whole nother topic and I don't want to take us down a rat hole. That's a whole nother aspect. But someday I'll tell you that story over a cup of coffee or a beer or something.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. Hey, and I know since AB 1482, there's a concept known as just cause now, which I guess restricts evictions a bit. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it actually restricts evictions quite a lot. AB 1482 was the law that got passed in California, which basically created California statewide rent control. The statewide rent control applies to any apartment building or any multifamily building, which is more than 15 years old. People say 15 years from when? The sad part is all the time. It's a rolling 15 years, right? So In that law, what they said was you cannot evict the tenant unless you have just cause. And there is a long list of things that are just cause. Now, they contain a lot of the same kind of things that you would find as normal basis for just cause. So, for example, if a person doesn't pay the rent, that's just cause. If they're causing a nuisance, if they violate a provision of the lease, a material provision of the lease, those are all things that are just cause. You also have a cause when there's no fault. So you can have just cause at fault or just cause no fault. No fault still allows you to evict the tenant if you, as the landlord and the owner, want to take possession of the property yourself. And of course, they're month to month, they're not in their term lease. If you want to put in a resident manager, if you want to demolish the building, if you want to go off the rental market, all of that stuff. But when you have no fault evictions, you are required to pay a relocation fee. Thankfully, the relocation fee really isn't that bad as compared to what it is in local jurisdictions. And it's a month of rent, which you can also just do as a credit as against the last month of rent.
Okay. So during the current time, filing unlawful detainers with the court system, I'm just wondering, realistically, are the courts open and hearing cases? And if so, how long would it be realistically for a landlord to get to appear and state their case before a judge?
Once again, we're talking about differences of months and months, depending on where you live, what county you live in, and believe it or not, what court you are assigned to. It's a complete and total mess.
Wow.
I don't want to sugarcoat it. If you are in San Bernardino, if you're in, you'll get there faster. And yes, the courts are open, to answer your question. All of the courts are open. They were never really closed per se, but there were very, very limiting rules, such as the judicial council rules, which expired in 2020, which just limited your access to what you could file. When those expired and they were replaced by AB 3088, then you had to contend with the differences between some local jurisdictions and AB 3088 and the state restrictions of AB 3088. And the fact that some local jurisdictions didn't care that the state rules got submitted and made law, they just want to stick with their own local rules. And if you don't like it, take it up with the court. It's pretty much their attitude. So in terms of the time it takes, it really depends on what happens. For example, let's say for defaults, a lot of times tenants just don't answer complaints. Theoretically speaking, once 5 court days pass, you're supposed to be able to default the tenant and from there get a default judgment for possession. Well, for example, at the end of 2020, the presiding judge of Los Angeles decided, you know what, we're just going to have court holidays for a month. He just declared court holiday in LA. What that means is that the answer isn't due for an additional month.
Wow.
A judge took the law, which says in the law, it's 5 court days. And he changed that law to 3 to 5 court days plus this extra month at the end of 2020. He's not allowed to do that. That is legislating. But they did it. And because it's a short amount of time, there's nothing anybody can really do about it. In Oakland, for example, they decided that they're going to still have the same rules as when the Judicial Council emergency rules were in place. So we submitted a case in November, come to find that they're still requiring, as they did during the emergency rules time, landlords to come in and have a whole ex parte hearing and explain to the judge why there's a public health and safety issue before they will even issue you the complaint with a stamp on it. Now, that was the rule until September 1st of 2020, California-wide, but it expired. Well, in Oakland, they decided not, it didn't expire. That's what we still want to have. They don't even have a local rule, a local Oakland county or city ordinance to support this, as far as I can tell.
That was going to be my question. I mean, because you do hear of cities passing their own eviction moratoriums and such, but you're talking about the court just arbitrarily sort of deciding what they're going to hear. Is that right?
Sometimes, yes. Oh. And passing these issues. In Long Beach, they just decided we're not doing defaults anymore. That wasn't even a judge. That was a clerk. A clerk told us, we're not doing UD defaults. We're just not stamping them. We said, why? They're like, oh, that's just what the supervisor told us. If you have a problem with it, talk to the supervisor.
So I'm guessing that some of this stuff has to do with the flood of issues that have been caused by COVID-19, the pandemic. I'm guessing that, right? Yes. Because there's just such an amazing backlog right now. So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about financial distress due to COVID.
Yeah.
Rights and protection under the COVID-19 Tenant Relief Act. You mentioned it a bit ago, AB 3088. Help us understand. I know the process and the requirements are substantially different. And even within the act itself, there are different time periods for how you would need to treat a tenant based on when they miss their rent payments or when their impact occurred.
Correct. So I think everyone probably heard about the cancel rent movement that was certainly very, very loud in 2020 and really precipitated by COVID. I just want to explain what this was in practical, realistic terms. A legislature cannot cancel rent. People can yell and scream all day long, but they can't cancel rent without paying the landlord the rent, because that's called a taking. It's unconstitutional, right? The government, at least nowadays, look, under current constitutional provisions that we have, the government can't come in and say, yeah, well, there was an emergency and this tenant doesn't owe you that rent anymore, period. They can't do that, because now they've taken your property from the landlord and given it to the tenant, even if it's for a short period of time, without compensating the landlord. That means the government just stole your property for a little while. That's not allowed. Now, the legislature knows that, but they wanted to try and figure out a way to cancel rent legally. And so they passed AB 3088, and they put in a bunch of these provisions that, practically speaking, cancel rent without actually doing it for real. How does that work? They said, okay, we're going to have 3 time periods. We're going to go from March 1st till August 30th, 2020. If you didn't pay rent from March 1st to August 30th, 2020, first, as a landlord, you would have had to give your tenants a special notice that explains what their rights are under AB 3088 by September 30th. If you didn't do that, then all the rent from March 1st to August 31st immediately becomes what's called consumer debt. It means that they technically, legally owe you the money, i.e., the state did not take it from you. You still have a right to go collect it. However, you cannot evict them for not paying. If you can't evict the tenant for not paying a particular kind of rent, for all practical purposes, it's a taking, because your right to repossess the property is the primary right you have to enforce the rental obligation. It's not suing. So that was how they dealt with that period in one sense. In another sense, they say, fine, if you give this notice by September 30th, you also have to give them a 15-day notice to cure or quit. It was 15 business days, just really 3 weeks. And what this notice said was, you have three options as the tenant in response. You can pay the rent, you can leave, or you can check a box on the attached declaration saying that you weren't able to pay the rent or any part of it due to a COVID-related circumstance. A COVID-related circumstance, which is actually pretty close to the definition used by almost every single local ordinance, is anything related to COVID that has also impacted you financially. So that means lost a job, lost hours at a job, ended up having to pay a caretaker to take care of kids.
Medical payments,
mm-hmm. Literally anything. If it's money and COVID and as a result, the tenant had less money, then that is a reason they can use to basically support that declaration. As long as they're making less than 130% of whatever your local average median income is, it was self-certifying. In other words, they did not have to provide you any proof. And that's still the case with the second time period we'll talk about in a second. If you do have evidence to suggest, or you do have a good faith belief as the landlord, that the person or the family is making more than 130% of the average median income, then you could check a box on the notice, and then they would have to provide you some sort of evidence of their inability to pay. Because believe it or not, we had a lot of people who were not paying the rent, checking these declarations, right? And then the landlord would see them roll around in brand new six-figure Mercedes or BMWs and, you know, with new clothes on from Versace, and then not paying the rent.
Well, and so typically a landlord has accepted a rental application where they've provided some proof of income. So they have some some knowledge of how much that tenant makes unless they've lost their job.
Correct. But and that's where the law sort of was designed to give people options, because a person could have been making $200,000 a year, certainly well above the AMI, but they lost their job completely.
Correct.
Making $0 a year, that would qualify. But that person would have to provide evidence of that. And so if a person does claim that, but they're also rolling around in brand new luxury cars, something doesn't add up. So at least the legislature was wise enough not to allow people who are making that kind of money and still make that kind of money from abusing this system to stop paying rent to landlords when they have no good reason to do so. From September 1st to January 31st is what they call in the law the transition period. During the transition period, you could send a notice to a tenant basically every month, right? And each time you would send them the notice, it would supplant whatever the notice was for the prior month. The difference here is that they would have to reply to the notice every single month, right? If they didn't reply to the notice, then you can actually evict them even back in 2020. And believe it or not, we had a lot of tenants who just ignored these notices completely. They didn't pay, they didn't quit, and they didn't write back with a declaration under penalty of perjury saying, I cannot pay as a result of a COVID-related circumstance. For those people, you can just go ahead and file the eviction. You have your 15-day notice, you have their failure, and we did actually start filing evictions even back in 2020 for this reason. Theoretically speaking, the law does provide that even if they don't provide the notice in a timely fashion, they can come to the court and provide the notice during that hearing or during that proceeding. And as long as they can show some sort of excusable mistake or inadvertence or negligence, and there's virtually no way to prove that it wasn't that, the judge will give them a pass and cancel the eviction. But we had situations where they didn't do that. And were played in courts where we could get defaults, we were getting default judgments. And again, this is even back in 2020. So that goes till January 31st as the law stands today. February 1st, as the law stands today, 3088 expires and you can start doing evictions right then. What's the importance of the date March 1st as it stands today? Again, in order to strengthen the constitutionality here, what they said was, we know a lot of landlords would not be able to go to a lawyer and start filing claims for large amounts of rent, but they're stuck with very low jurisdictional limits on small claims access. So if you're a landlord and your property is owned by an LLC or a corporation, a partnership, something that is a fictional entity, when you go to small claims court, you are only allowed to sue for a limit of $5,000, and B, you're only allowed to go twice a year, twice in every 12-month period. So what the legislature did was said, if you are a landlord and you are collecting COVID rent, both of those limitations are removed starting March 1st. You can go to small claims, ask for any amount of money you want for COVID rent, and you can file as many claims as you want for COVID rent. So starting March 1st, theoretically, if the law doesn't change, you're going to see an avalanche, a tsunami of small claims cases get filed by landlords.
Wow. And you made a good point as it stands today. I mean, what's the likelihood that this won't change? Because, I mean, there's this complete surge going on in all of California, it's Southern California in particular. Something's going to happen here, I would imagine.
Right. So a San Francisco legislator did submit a bill called AB 15, which is currently making its way through several committees. AB 15 is just far too drastic. But what it says is they want to take that January 31st, 2021 date and make it December 31st, 2021. In other words, take AB 38 and make it.
Put it through the entire year. Yeah, the entire year 2021.
Yeah, exactly. Which is just, it's insane. And I don't think it will pass the California Assembly and Senate as draft. It seems far too excessive. So it's the same thing in the court where judges and clerks are making up their own mind as to what to enforce, what not to enforce, what rules to make, what not rules to make. They're putting their own personal spins on things. So it kind of doesn't even matter necessarily what happens with the AB 15. We might get still stuck with a lot of these local rules being made and local jurisdictions also flouting the law anyway. In Los Angeles, the city of Los Angeles's law basically says our eviction moratorium runs until the local jurisdiction is over, period, until Mayor Garcetti says it's done. That's not what the state law says. The state law was supposed to supplant all the local moratoriums, and LA says, no, we want ours. We like ours. That's okay.
So that would take precedence, the LA moratorium?
It shouldn't. That's not the law. Mm-hmm. It directly conflicts with the state law, and the state law should preempt. But the city's saying, no, we think our law is perfectly fine. And if you don't like it, take it up with the judge.
What about the CDC moratorium? Where does that come into play?
That gets into an issue of federalism, because the CDC is obviously not part of the legislative branch. They're basically trying to make some sort of executive order. It's supposed to also expire January 31st. I've never actually seen someone use the CDC as a defense, because theoretically speaking, the federal government is not supposed to be getting involved with state laws. And all eviction laws in any state are a matter of state law. It would be tantamount to CDC coming out and saying, okay, no more divorces until it's done, because we don't want people to separate or live in different right. houses.
Good luck with that one.
Right. Right. There's literally no difference. You can't do that. You can't, the federal government is really not permitted to come in and start meddling in state law issues, yet they have. And it's the CDC. It's not even the legislature. It's not even the Congress. So it's confusing. And now then it gets down to that. Is a judge going to look at this and say, well, no, this is unconstitutional. I'm not buying this, as some judges have done in different states and even in California. Or is a judge going to look at this and say, ha, this is great. I have an excuse to basically support my own personal opinion of what should be done here. And if that judge thinks no evictions, period, then they're going to use anything that's at their disposal, including a CDC moratorium. So it really comes down to that particular judge, that particular clerk, that particular sheriff, what their opinion is on the subject.
My goodness. We could probably talk about this for another hour, a couple hours, right? But in the interest of time, we do sort of need to wrap up. I've taken now almost 50 minutes of your time. But before we break, I always like to ask my guests to tell a story. I'm kind of a storyteller. I like to use it to connect with people. So do you have a story you can share briefly?
You know, one story I kind of like to tell, and it's just something I try to remember about everything that happens to me in my life. And I think, you know, anybody who's married can probably understand this. But, you know, if you're a normal, regular person, member of society, before you get married, you probably go through your fair share of different relationships. Didn't work out. Certainly, you know, starting from high school and to college and maybe even after. And when you think about who you were and what you were experiencing when you went through those things, especially if you're younger, it just kind of feels like the entire world is ending. And you don't really understand why you're going through necessarily a challenging event in your life, something that's really ripping your heart out, until at the end of the day, you finally get to who you're married to. And you realize that if all that stuff hadn't happened, you never would have gotten to the person you were actually meant to be with. All of it was some sort of a process that shaped you. And you're probably glad you didn't end up with any of those people, because then you wouldn't have met who your husband or your wife is. I remember a very specific situation that really kind of crystallized it for me. I was sleeping, I was having a dream, and in the dream, I don't know if this happens to other people, I'll let you in on just like my personal dream experiences. It was just one of those things where you're having to relive a particularly difficult termination of a relationship. And you're having to just re-feel all those feelings, which is really unpleasant. And I remember when I woke up because my kids and my wife were all sitting there on the bed. And they had come to wake me up and jump up and down on the bed with me and say good morning. And I kind of felt like that was a, you know, if you want to call it God or if you want to call it the universe, coming in and, you know, knocking on the door or knocking on the window and saying, hey, see, remember all of that stuff that you went through? This is why. And the universe basically saying, next time you have to go through something difficult, next time you have to go through something challenging, remember, I had you at that time. I knew what I was doing. So next time you go through the challenging thing, just remember that. I got you this time. If I had you last time, I got you this time. And you're going to get to that waking up again sometime soon.
That's a cool story. Reminds me of an old Garth Brooks song, Unanswered Prayers. I don't know if you ever heard of that. He thanks God for unanswered prayers because he ended up, you know, with the woman he really loved instead of the woman he was praying about, I guess, back to God, you know, when he was going through that breakup or that relationship.
And Rascal Flatts rewrote the song as, you know, God Bless the Broken Road. There's a lot of really good country songs about that particular topic. And, you know, they mean a lot to me personally, because I definitely feel like having that in mind helps me get through every challenging experience. And as a lawyer, there are a lot of them.
Yeah, particularly with what you do. It's a cool story because, you know, you help people get through a lot of difficult situations, I have no doubt. Hey, listen, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show today. I love the story. I would love to continue. Any last words or thoughts for our audience?
Yeah, I'll tell you one, because I know I've been pretty much a downer this entire time. I'll tell you one piece of good news and that I heard from all of my clients throughout this whole pandemic thing. When it first hit, and they started doing stay-at-home orders and, you know, the entire world basically shutting down, all of my clients were terrified that everyone was just going to stop paying the rent.
So were we. Yeah. So was my company, right? A lot of property managers were just, you know, wondering what the heck is going to, you know, doom and gloom, right?
Yeah. Everyone thought the rents were going to go down to 50%, 30% payment. And I was just so happy when my clients came back and told me that they were experiencing, at worst, the worst number I heard was 80, 85% payment. And I heard many, many instances of 92, 95, 98% of people paying their rent. And it was just, I felt like that was a miracle, because people were basically being told on the news, you don't have to pay your rent. You have this moratorium, that moratorium, you can't get evicted. And people were still paying their rent. You know, people were still going to work. They're still making money. They were still paying the rent. And it suggests to me that it's bad out there. No one's saying it isn't. It's a dangerous time. It's a scary time. But I don't think it's as bad as it could be. And I actually don't even think it's as bad as everyone thinks it is.
We had a couple of forbearance requests, but everybody came current and we've been 100%, which is astonishing to me. So, right. I'm going to knock on wood here, but, we've been very fortunate. Hey, listen, Niv, if someone wanted to learn more about Davidich Stein, what's the best way to get connected, to find you guys, to get in touch?
So you can check out our website. It's davidovichlaw.com. That's D-A-V-I-D. O-V as in Victor, I-C-H-L-A-W.com. You can always call us at the main line, which is 818-661-2420. You can ask for me. You can ask for my partner, Charlie Stein. He's the head of the UD department. But it's on my email address, so I can give it to everybody. Anyone, if you want to get a hold of me personally, best way to contact me is just call me on my number. It's 310-877-2834. That's my mobile. I pretty much have it on me all the time. And if you need help, we'll be glad to help you out.
Hey, and Niv, I don't know if you remember this, I'm the president of CalNARPM. You're going to be one of our breakout session speakers. I'm going to be pumped up. You and I speak at the same time, so I'm not going to be able to hear you. But for anybody who's considering registering and attending the CalNARPM conference coming up here in March, you'll be able to hear Niv go into greater detail than perhaps we were able to on today's episode. Hey, thank you so much, Niv. Great episode. Thank good you, content. Bob. You weren't a downer. You were just telling us like it is. And that's exactly what I was looking for today's episode.
Okay, great. Great. Thank you so much for having me, Bob. I really appreciate
you it. You bet. Thank you. As we wrap up today, I'd like to make another quick plug to our listeners to click on the subscribe button and give us a like. Also, please pay it forward with a positive review to help encourage more great guests to come on the show. That concludes today's episode of the Property Management Brainstorm. Thank you for joining. Until next time, we will be in the field working hard for our clients to maximize rental income and property value while maintaining top tenant relations. And we'll catch you next time.